What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I speak with Andrew Nagorski. Andrew Nagorski is an award-winning journalist and author who spent more than three decades as a foreign correspondent and editor for Newsweek. From 1990 to 1994, he served as Newsweek's Warsaw bureau chief, and he served two tours of duty as Newsweek's Moscow bureau chief, first in the early 1980s, and then from 1995 to 1996. In 1982, he gained international notoriety when the Soviet government, angry about his enterprising reporting, expelled him from the country. After spending the next 2.5 years as Rome bureau chief, he became Bonn bureau chief. He's written a new book, Saving Freud. Saving Freud uncovers the gripping tale of Sigmund Freud's escape from Nazi-occupied Vienna and the remarkable collection of people, Freud's personal physician, Napoleon's great-grandniece, the heiress to the Tiffany fortune, his daughter Anna, an American ambassador, and his English language translator, all of whom risked everything to protect his life and legacy. And now I give you Andrew Nagorski.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with Andrew Nagorski. Andrew, thanks for coming on the podcast, sir.
Pleasure to be with you here.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Andrew. Obviously, I want to discuss your career. I certainly want to discuss your new book, Saving Freud. Before we do, please tell listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Well, I've been a journalist almost of my entire life, a journalist and an author. I started out as a high school history teacher that lasted about 3 years and then went into journalism, spent more than three decades with Newsweek magazine. When magazines were very different than they are today, when they were real magazines with foreign staffs and so forth. And I became a foreign correspondent and served in places like Germany, Poland, Russia, also Hong Kong, Rome. And so I had a wonderful career there. But as I was writing more and more longer form material, I gradually transitioned to writing mostly books. I still do freelance pieces here and there, but my main focus is on writing stories, writing histories that really I try to bring to life the period, the people, and try to place myself and then and thus the reader in these situations where people found themselves, especially in the beginning of the first half of the 20th century. When you had so many cataclysmic events, two world wars, the Russian Revolution, Hitler coming to power, the rise of fascism in Italy as well. And my own background, just quickly, is my parents grew up in Poland. And my father served in the Polish army in World War II. When the Germans attacked, managed to escape, ended up eventually by various means of escape, getting to Britain when serving with Polish forces under British command. And after the war, they stayed in Scotland where he had been deployed. And I was born in Scotland, which is in Edinburgh, which is why my name is Andrew, the patron saint of Edinburgh. But the fact that you may detect, have a little hard time detecting my Scottish accent has to do with the fact that I left when I was 10 months old. My parents at that point moved us to the state, moved to the States. My grandfather had been in the Polish government in exile in London, which was the anti-communist government. So there's no going back to Poland after Stalin's forces took over. And so I was raised as an American, but very quickly moving around the world as well, because my Polish immigrant father became a U.S. diplomat. And for about 10 years, we bounced around the world. So I guess I absorbed a lot of that because I ended up doing the same thing with my children.
Indeed. Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate you running through that. So yeah, I am curious about how you got into journalism. So I suppose winding the clock back, what was it that attracted you to the trade?
Well, again, I have to say a little bit of my father's influence, because when he was serving even in the Polish Army in World War II, at a certain point, he got assigned to work for the Polish Army newspaper. And so he began covering the war more than being an active participant as he'd been earlier. And then when he came to the States as an immigrant, he did all sorts of things just trying to survive. But one of the things was he started a little news service about Eastern Europe, what was going on in those days behind what was called the Iron Curtain. So I always had in my head, he always encouraged me to write, to report. I saw him doing it. And then in college, I wrote for the college newspaper, enjoyed it, but I wasn't sure exactly what I would wanted to do. And I taught a couple of summers in various summer programs involved in those days in, as part of the civil rights movement. And I taught, as I mentioned, I taught for about 3 years. And as much as I enjoyed it, I taught at a suburban Boston high school teaching social studies. I realized I did want to try to write, and I took a bit of a flyer and moved my very young family. I'd been married already and had two kids, and it for what was called a tryout to New York at Newsweek. In those days, they had something where if they thought you might make it, they'd invite you for a tryout, but it could be anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months, or actually anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 months. At the end of any week, they could say, you're hired, or nice try, kid, go home. And well, we moved, I took the risk, and it kept me hanging for the entire 6 months. But at the end of it, I did get hired. And that really was, I was lucky enough to get that break. And so I started out in the New York office, editing, rewriting, doing all the things one did in a news magazine, but then lobbying pretty soon to go abroad as a foreign correspondent, which was really what I wanted to do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's incredible. Thank you, Andrew. I didn't know about the Newsweek having tryouts, and you said that they left you hanging for the 6 months. If you don't mind my asking, and if you just tell me, were you paid through that 6 months?
Yes, you were paid. It was kind of the, ground level pay, but it was actually maybe even a little bit better than I was getting as a high school teacher, in those days, which wasn't much either. But you got paid for the time you were on the tryout at a basic level, but it wasn't until you really got hired that, your conditions improved some, if they did improve. It was a revolving door. I remember a lot of people coming in and out, and you were almost nervous about saying hello to them, getting too friendly with them, because the next day they might be gone. So it was a nerve-wracking time, but it meant that they were willing to take risks on people without. All I had was my college clips, basically.
Very interesting. One question I always love asking to writers and editors that I'm lucky enough to interview, Andrew, what would you say is the difference between a good editor and a bad editor?
That's a good question. I've thought about it because I have done some editing stints and for a while at Newsweek. Before I became a foreign correspondent, they already had me a little bit on an editing track. And I realized it's intriguing to do that, but I really wanted to go out and report and be in the field. But it's a real skill to be a good editor. I think one of the big differences is editors who are not particularly sure of themselves, who are not very skilled, often tend to do too much. They try to put their stamp on every part of the story. An editor's job, I feel, whether it's you're writing articles or you're writing books, is to help the writer tell the best story in his or her own way but not to write, not to have them in the writer tell the story in the way the editor would have told the story.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fine but important distinction. It should be the writer's voice. And a good editor can spot the things that really don't work. And a wonderful editor at Simon & Schuster for about five of my books, Alice May, who was a very legendary editor there, who did Woodward and Bernstein and did a lot of the big historians. And she was just fabulous in terms of she would get something I'd write, and she would say, oh, yeah, very good, very good. You know, in that, you know, that part in the middle of this chapter where you talk about so-and-so, it's a good story, but it really is not critical to your narrative. Think about owning that back or explaining a little more of this and that, where you're assuming the reader knows certain things that there's no reason why the reader necessarily knows it. So you have to really think of what is essential to the story, what should go in, what goes out. Of course, there's stylistic points, but again, especially in news magazines in the old days, like Newsweek and Time, there was often a tremendous amount of over-editing, which meant that the individual voice got lost. And there was this tendency, again, I'd say, of insecure editors to try to put too much into it to prove to their superiors, oh, I really had big input on this story. That's, you have to be able as an editor to, I think, keep your ego in check a lot more than as a writer, where you can be more. Writers are famously egotistical. But in a way, that's part of the game. And that's part, you have to have your own style, your own voice. But an editor should be enabling you to get the best out of you, but not overwhelming you.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I would feel as you do. I interviewed someone a while back whose name you might know, actually, the dearly departed Victor Nevasky.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And he said, I won't say verbatim, but more or less the same thing, that an editor, half the job of the editor is to get out of his or her own way and to bring the writer's voice to bear. Otherwise, if it becomes the editor's story, then why not just give it to the editor to write?
Exactly, exactly. And that's the hardest thing, I think, often, is that self-restraint. And when I was editing, I often felt, suddenly had this impulse, okay, I would do this differently and that differently. And say, wait a minute, this is not my story.
Right.
Think of what will be the best thing for the writer's story, not for the way I would have written this story if I had started from scratch.
Indeed, indeed. I could go down this rabbit hole with you all day, Andrew. I really could. But just to move through, I know you were, as you mentioned before, you were a bureau chief at various areas with Newsweek, including, if I'm not mistaken, Warsaw and Hong Kong.
Yes.
I'd love to know, first, for any listeners that might not be familiar, what exactly is a bureau chief? What would he or she do? And I'd love to know what that experience was like for you.
For someone like myself at Newsweek, bureau is a somewhat exalted term. We had bureaus, which meant an office. And in the old days, when the news magazines had pretty good budgets, maybe there'd be two correspondents, or in some, like a Paris bureau, when there were a lot of stories in Europe, maybe three correspondents. But usually, often it was one correspondent, an assistant, maybe a driver in a place like Moscow or Hong Kong, where you needed logistical support, and maybe someone who was kind of a researcher fixer. So it was a pretty small operation. It always amused me a little bit when I'd be called, so and I was in some bureau, and someone would say, I'd like to talk to your sports department. Well, hold on a minute. Sports department? Now, you're the correspondent. And it's, if chances are it's you alone or one or maybe one other, and in very exceptional cases, two other reporters. So you did whatever stories, and we did primarily political, economic, big stories, geopolitical stories. But if there was a sports story to be done, we did it. If there was an art story to be done, we did it. So a bureau just designates an office, and whoever is the bureau chief is the one who is in charge of the budget, making the assignments if there are people to assign. Because sometimes, even if you're alone, you also work with people who are called stringers. These are not staff correspondents, but people in the area. For instance, if I was based in Bonn in the 80s during the Cold War, and I had responsibility for all of Eastern Europe, they might have a stringer in Budapest, someone who worked on a particular assignment, was not on staff, but would just be paid for whatever assignment they fulfilled. So you were in charge of those kinds of operations.
Gotcha. Thank you. And then what were those experiences like for you? I suppose I'll ask it this way. What was the experience in Moscow like for you? I'm anxious to know.
Well, I was there twice in Moscow. First time was 1981-82. So it's the early day. It's still the Cold War. Leonid Brezhnev is the Soviet ruler at the time. And given my background, I grew up speaking Polish because I mentioned that my parents came from Poland and we spoke Polish at home. So I had a Slavic language, but then I had to learn Russian. And in those days, Newsweek and a lot of news organizations were willing to send you to language school before going to an important assignment like Moscow. So I did 12 weeks of intensive Russian. But it was the most challenging assignment at the time. It was the big story, of course, the Cold War. But it was also in many ways the most satisfying for me, because in much of journalism, you feel that so many times you're covering a story and there are all sorts of other correspondents are covering that same story. And you may do it a little better or a little worse than the others, but it's hard to really say, oh, I've done a story that nobody else is doing or could have done. In Moscow in those days in the Cold War, when there were all sorts of restrictions, you were shadowed by the KGB. You had all sorts of, you knew everything was monitored. They had your apartment bugged. Everything was restrictive. You had to work a way around the system. And most importantly, you had to find people willing to talk to you. And they were taking the big risks much more than you were as a correspondent, because ultimately what might happen is what happened to me. I got kicked out of the Soviet Union in 1982 because they did not like my reporting. They did not like who I was seeing when I was writing. But the Russian, the Soviet sources who took the risk of meeting with me, informing me of a lot of things, were much more at risk. They could be thrown into prison, into psychiatric wards in those days, which they did with dissidents. So this was not a game. And so it made it, but it made it also doubly satisfying when you got out there, got a story, and you could tell a story about something that most readers were not familiar with at all. And almost traveling any place within the Soviet Union in those days, very often I went to places where they had hardly ever seen a Western correspondent. And so any story you could bring back, even about ordinary life, for instance, I went up to northern Russia to an area which was dairy country traditionally in the 19th century in the old Russian Empire. It was famous for its butter and exported butter and milk products to France. But this was in the Soviet Union. The economy was collapsing. And I went up there and wrote a story about how you couldn't get milk or butter anywhere. And you just went around and found out these things. And you had a sense, well, I'm at least offering a bit of a window on what a failure this system is, so people understand it, because it was even hard for people to imagine until you actually went there and saw it and got the evidence. People would say, oh, much of that must be exaggerated. Well, you could find out for yourself if you worked at it. Or else I went to Tajikistan in Central Asia, one of the Soviet republics, where mostly young Muslims were being recruited for their war in Afghanistan. I talked to these young guys and how much they hated the notion of going to fight across the border. So that was a really interesting experience, but it was very clear that the authorities were unhappy with my reporting and they did various things. As I mentioned here, the tailing became much more overt, which, they could monitor you covertly, but when they did it overtly, it was to try to intimidate you, and especially to intimidate people who were talking to you. So it's dangerous to have any contact with this guy. And when I ignored all that, they eventually just expelled me. So I was actually the last American correspondent to be expelled from the old Soviet Union. There was one other correspondent 4 years later, a colleague from U.S. News Report, who was actually imprisoned for 13 days. But that was because they wanted to accuse him of spying, to do a spy exchange for a KGB guy that the Americans had caught in the U.S. So it was a very fraught time, mm-hmm. but it was certainly an unbelievable experience.
Yeah, and not unexciting, I'm sure.
No. It wasn't dull.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I appreciate you running through that for us. So I'm very interested in discussing your book, Saving Freud, The Rescuers Who Brought Him to Freedom. I want to start by asking you how you came to Freud as a subject.
You know, I never imagined I would write a book about Freud. I took Psych 101 in college, like a lot of people do, and I found it interesting, but I was never planning to study psychology in any depth. But I came through a process. Several of my books before then concerned the rise of the Nazis, your interwar Europe, and then how people react to these events, and what did they recognize? What did they see coming or not see coming, which was often more the case? Because we always say, you look at history in retrospect, we all say, oh, I would have realized the danger of Hitler or the Nazi movement, or I would have realized what was about to happen.
We would have said something.
Much less I would have been courageous enough to really stand up to it or something. People have a lot of illusions on that score. And my own experience reporting from the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe in the run-up to the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the breaching of the Berlin Wall was that when you're in the midst of a story like that, it's very hard to really recognize the full dimensions of what's happening around you. It takes a lot of insight and luck, and you can get a lot of things wrong. And so I've written books, for instance, one called Hitlerland, about Americans in Germany in the 20s and 30s, and precisely about what people saw or missed. And in between, when I finished my, and then some books about the war and the key decisions of the war and leadership, and I'm always fascinated about the role of individuals in history and how they shape history. But what got me going on this was I was reading a memoir of an Austrian Jewish writer early in the 20th century. He was incredibly popular. His name was Stefan Zweig. And he wrote novellas and plays. He was very prolific. And he was certainly the most popular writer in the German language, but even in other languages. And I was reading a memoir of his that was reissued not too long ago called The World of Yesterday. And it's a beautiful memoir about turn of the century, early 20th century Vienna. And in that memoir, he describes he was a contemporary of Freud's, how he met Freud in Vienna, his impressions of him. And I was already my curiosity was aroused by his very vivid description of Freud. And, Freud is this one of these iconic figures. We all think we kind of know him, but I realized I didn't know much about him at all. And beyond the very superficial observations, but as a human being, most people don't know him, about his dry sense of humor, his whole style of living. And he describes meeting Freud, his impressions of him, and about the very interesting circle of colleagues and patients around Freud. And then Zweig is in Austria, and Hitler comes to power next door in Germany in 1933. And Zweig and his wife leave Austria, realizing this neighborhood is getting too dangerous. But Freud doesn't. He stays. And the next time in Zweig's memoir that he mentions Freud, it's in 1938, after Hitler's forces have taken over Austria and incorporated Austria into the Third Reich, called the Anschluss. And the next time Freud appears in this memoir of Zweig is in 1938, arriving in London after he barely gets out of Vienna. And I think, wait a minute, this is a part of the story. First of all, most people don't associate Freud with Hitler's rise to power, the beginning of World War II, because he was born in 1856.
Right.
So he's kind of a mid-19th century to mid, not even mid, but sort of early part of 20th century. His fame was the highest kind of in the early 1900s, the 1910s, 1920s. And the fact that Freud, in fact, lived right until World War II just started. So he lived through all this. And I started reading and some memoirs and letters and so forth and said, there's an intriguing story about Freud. First of all, why did he stick around so long in Austria? here's a guy who's so perceptive about the human mind and about the dark side of human behavior. Why didn't he see this coming? Or did he see it coming and ignored it? Yeah, that was a big question to me. And then when, for whatever reason, he was still there, Hitler's forces come into Vienna. Hitler is literally speaking in Vienna, just a short way away from Freud's apartment. And Freud's in the apartment with his family. I didn't say, how did he get out? And then I discovered that there was this whole group of people around him, what I call his rescue squad, people who were a fascinating group. Some of them started as his patients, others as his acolytes, and who became so devoted to Freud that they mounted this major rescue operation that got him out at the last minute. And that, I just found it was a combination of, I wanted to know much more about Freud. I started digging back into his own past, and then about these people around him. That's what really got me going. I mean, just to give you one example, one of the people who is a really central character is Marie Bonaparte. Now, Bonaparte, a rather familiar name, Napoleon Bonaparte. She was the great grandniece of Napoleon. Mm-hmm. And she had gone to Freud for help with sexual matters, which is not uncommon with Freud's patients. And she, in the end, becomes a psychoanalyst herself, devoted follower of Freud, a major supporter of the psychoanalytic movement, which, remember, Freud created this from scratch. And she is also wealthy. She's a celebrity. She's married to the Prince of Greece and Denmark. In those days, royalty was still a big thing. She has resources, and she's a major figure in this rescue squad. So when I started looking at these various figures, and then there are Americans and Brits and others. And so I thought, it's a book that revolves around Freud and the decisions or lack of decisions in his life that got him in this situation in the first place. But then also Illuminatus shows who these whole circle consisted of. And each one of them would be a lovely subject for a biography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's an incredible story, and one that I'm slightly embarrassed to tell you I hadn't heard before your book. Feels like one of those incredible stories that fell through the cracks, and you wonder how it fell through the cracks.
I didn't know much of this story before, so don't be embarrassed, because when I'm writing in this field of the early 20th century and the rise of the Nazis and all this, you say, there have been so many books on these subjects. How can you come up with something new? So when I came across this, and especially with a famous figure such as Sigmund Freud, who was probably the biggest celebrity in the earliest 20th century, to discover a story that was, largely unknown except to a small group of people, and to say, I can develop this story. And luckily, also, one of the key elements of why I love writing about this story is that there was so much great material. And if Freud, in those days, wrote letters to everyone, and his supporters wrote letters back and forth, and that some of them wrote diaries and so forth, but mostly it was correspondence. And these were not text messages and emails, cryptic things. These were long letters, very evocative, and you almost felt you're sitting there and seeing how he's experiencing all these events and how his friends are experiencing the events. And I sort of pity future historians who are going to have to try to recreate the world we live in based on much less, well-developed narratives that are already there. And so all this material was extraordinarily rich, and I just found it fascinating. To give you one example, when Freud was courting his wife, Martha, for 4 years, they courted at a distance. She lived near Hamburg in northern Germany. He lived in Vienna. He felt he didn't have the professional standing and the money to start a family. So they were writing letters to each other, and they wrote about 900 letters to each other in those days. And you read those letters, and suddenly you get a picture not only of their lives, but of their personalities. And so, I got in some ways to psychoanalyze Freud a little. So that was fun, too.
No, I appreciate that, Andrew. Chopping up the bit to ask you, because I want to give our listeners maybe a sense of the what shall we call it, the landscape at the time. As you already hinted at, you know, Freud coined the term psychoanalysis, I believe, in 1896. I'd love to know, can you speak about the scientific and cultural movement and how it grew in Vienna around this time?
Well, the Vienna medical establishment was very famous, but also famously conservative in terms of its practices, the academic life. And at first, Freud thought he was just going to be a neurologist, a researcher. He might work in a research lab, and he did work in a lab for a while. But Freud was someone who was always driven to, he wanted to get something more out of life. He felt he wanted to discover something about, he was fascinated by the human mind, and it was not just in terms of what he could discern from dissecting, for instance, eels, which was one of his early assignments, but about human behavior. And he was seeing, and he experimented with all sorts of things. He experimented at one point early on, he thought cocaine was going to be the wonder drug that could help cure people with severe mental disorders and have no side effects. Of course, that turned out to be
incorrect.
He quickly discovered that was not the case. Became fascinated by hypnosis, which was particularly carried out by a number of French physicians, and to study that for a while. So he was looking always for what is it that I can find to make myself useful and also to build a career. Because part of the reason he wanted to marry Martha also was he wanted his own medical practice. Because if he just was a researcher, it was kind of for very, very straight material reasons. It was a very frugal existence. He was still living with his parents. And he was looking for something beyond that. And then eventually he settles, he starts working with a mentor, and together they begin working out this, what they call the talking cure, which of course is what later he very cleverly rebrands as psychoanalysis. Talking cure doesn't sound like that evocative a name. Psychoanalysis, now that begins to resonate. And there are a lot of people who are skeptical of it at first, but over time, at first, he's seen as this marginal figure, but then it really becomes very, it fascinates people. By the way, a lot from the U.S. and Britain especially come, but all from other parts of Europe too, but U.S. and British patients come, and they want help from Freud and a small group of his colleagues who begin practicing this. And they, at first, they just meet around his kitchen table in Vienna. And then some of them create their own little circles, little psychoanalytic institutes, and take patients and develop the theories and practices that we know as psychoanalysis. And I said, and he's also, Freud was a very good writer. And so his early works also are very important to this. His whole interpretation of dreams, of all that, his famous works help move this along into the academic and then the public consciousness. And he sought out and he becomes this authority on the human mind, which elevates him remarkably after first being kind of this marginal figure in the medical establishment, eventually makes him probably the major figure in the medical establishment in Vienna and much of Europe.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, never forget that about Freud, by the way. He was a very, very good writer. I read, I only read one thing he ever wrote, Future of an Illusion. And I remember being struck by how well written it was. It didn't feel like I was reading a psychoanalytical work. I felt like I was reading from someone like yourself, you know, if you'll permit the compliment.
Well, I always permit that kind of compliment any day, but absolutely, he wrote in a way that was accessible to people.
Yeah.
It was not sort of this overly academic medical jargon. Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of that, but it was mostly he had a way of encapsulating things. And that's the other thing about psychoanalysis, that the way he presented it, I think, made it accessible to many people. To me, a classic example of this is Anna Freud, his youngest daughter, who becomes the closest child to him and also the one who follows in his path and becomes a major psychoanalyst in her own right, a child psychoanalyst. describes how when she was, I think, about 14, she's walking with her father in a very nice neighborhood in Vienna. And her father says, look at these houses, these beautiful houses here with their beautiful facades. And say, you know, yes, they're beautiful, but you don't know what's behind the facades. And you don't know what's inside, whether it's really beautiful. It's the same thing with the human mind. It's a very, you know, simple image way to convey that, and to convey what the psychoanalysis is all about. And that was, I think, Freud's real gift, that he managed to do that. And today, you know, a lot of psychologists said, oh, we moved beyond Freud and so forth. Trace their ideas. It all goes back to Freud.
Yeah.
You know, they may have developed them in different directions and have dealt with their own theories. But his impact, I think, on not only the field of psychoanalysis, but also the field of just popular perception, in a very even kind of crude way, psychoanalyze all sorts of people and events and so forth.
Yes, we do. To our detriment, one might argue.
Yeah, sometimes very much to our detriment, yes.
In the book you write, I pulled a quote here. In the book you write, begin quote, the notion that Austria would never resort to truly draconian policies was embedded in the psyche of Vienna's Jews for a generation, end quote. Could you talk a little bit more about that, Andrew?
Yes, well, when Freud was born in 1856, Austria was an empire. It was the Habsburg Empire, which soon became the Austro-Hungarian Empire. They gave Hungary a good deal of autonomy to try to keep things quiet. But it was an empire that spread over a large area, about 50 million people, which in those days was a lot of people, and about 9 different major nationalities, minorities, including Jews. And in Vienna, about 10% of the population was Jewish. And there was, of course, anti-Semitism. There were incidents, discrimination. And Freud encountered some of this in his own life, but he never let that stop him. And there was a sense that you could be a Jew in Vienna and do very well for yourself, as Freud did. He always was very proud that he was at the top of his class. He was, a lot of people were, you know, the professions were somewhat limited because some of them had been off limits to Jews before, but in the arts, in medicine, in teaching, academia, there were, Jews were, achieved very prominent positions, and some of the most famous people we associated, certainly with music and the arts and in other fields, are Austrian Jews. And so he did not let this, he had the sense that, yes, you could encounter anti-Semitism, is something you could encounter anytime, any place. And he never backed away from it, by the way. And in the book, I write about some incidents where he was confronted with anti-Semitism and immediately confronts the people, whoever attacks him, for being a Jew. And I should also note that Freud himself was Jewish, and he never denied that, but he was not a religious Jew at all. He considered himself, you know, he said, I'm culturally Jewish, but I'm not religiously Jewish. But he felt his Jewish heritage was very much part of his character. And so he said, I'm a Jew insofar as I will never pretend not to be a Jew, no matter what happens to Jews. So he had this sense, I think many Austrian Jews did, that you can live in this multicultural, multi-ethnic empire that was the Austro-Hungarian Empire and do quite well, even if there may be times you get literally or metaphorically beat up as a Jew. And of course, things begin to change very radically once the Nazis get involved. But initially, there was this feeling that Austria is going to be different. It was an illusion. I call it a little bit of the sound of music illusion, that Austrians are gentler. You know, they will never behave the way the German Nazis did. Of course, history turned out very differently. And the tragedy of Austria was that many of those, say, for instance, of the death camp commandants in the Nazi and during the Third Reich, a large proportion of them happened to be Austrian Nazis. So, but there was for a long time that illusion that many people clung, Austrian Jews clung to, that despite the ideology will somehow be okay.
Right, right. I understand that. There was a joke that I think came out of that whole Austrian thing. Perhaps you heard it. It was the two great achievements of Austria are to have convinced the world that Hitler was German and that Beethoven was Viennese.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah, that Hitler was German. Yeah, yeah, and, yeah, and Beethoven was an Austrian. Yeah. Of course, Beethoven was born in Bonn, Germany.
Indeed.
And Hitler was born in Austria.
Indeed.
And well, that's why even, yeah, in my books are setting up that scene of Vienna, what it was like in that early era as Freud was growing in stature. There was kind of, I would call Freud's Vienna, which was still in that tradition, multi-ethnic, pretty open, pretty flexible. And then there was Hitler's Vienna, because Hitler came as a young man to Vienna and tried to make his mark there and of course failed. He never got into art school in Vienna, which is one of those great things I'd like to talk to that admissions committee. Might have reconsidered.
Think of all the trouble they could have saved us.
Yes.
I'd love to ask you, Andrew, who was Ernest Jones and what was the role that he played in the book?
Ernest Jones was a Welshman who studied medicine. And as he was doing his medical studies, he became fascinated by Freud and his writings. At that time, Freud, most of his writings were only in German. Jones actually studied German very energetically so they could read Freud. And he became one of Freud's earliest followers and helped develop psychoanalysis, not only in Britain, and then later in the U.S., by the way, he went to U.S., to Canada and then the U.S., but also he later became the head of what became known as the International Psychoanalytic Movement. And he's one of these characters who's very colorful, who was always getting in trouble with his young doctor, always being accused of some inappropriate behavior. But Freud stuck by him, said, oh, we psychoanalysts were constantly accused of things because people, there's this transference where our patients often transfer their emotions to him. As my editor said, it's a good thing for Jones he did not live during the Me Too movement. He would not have survived that. But he was a very prolific writer, very energetic. He translated some of the stuff for Freud. He went into international conferences. And then he becomes a key figure in what I call this rescue squad, particularly in getting permission for Freud and his family to come to England, because there was, first of all, the task, how do you get him out of Austria when Austria is already under Hitler? But then if you even manage to do that, where do they go? Because at that point, there are very few places that were eager to give visas to Jews fleeing Nazi persecution. There was anti-Semitism in a lot of places, and Jones was very well connected in England and used every connection in the book to get permission for Freud and his family to come to Britain. And also later on, he became his first major biographer. He wrote a 3-volume biography of Freud after Freud's death, and that's still sort of the starting point when you're studying Freud's life.
Indeed. And I think you just broached the answer to my next question, so I'll ask it fully and just see where it takes us. I'd love to know under what conditions it was that Freud finally did escape Nazi Vienna. Was it simply a question of money or social and professional connections or both?
It was a connection. It was a combination of things. First of all, just very briefly, and this is, of course, described in the book in great detail, one of the reasons why Freud did not want to leave Vienna, aside from the fact that he just loved Vienna, his routines, he was a revolutionary thinker, but a very conservative man in terms of his personal habits and routines and didn't want to break any of them. But also, he had developed cancer of the jaw in the early 1920s, a result of his famous cigar smoking, which he refused to jettison. And so he'd undergone multiple operations, was in bad shape. So he was reluctant to leave. And it wasn't until literally the Nazis came banging on the door and bursting in, and also dragging his daughter Anna to the Gestapo for questioning, that Freud realized, we got to get out. Freud at this point was an old man, and he said, if it was only myself and my wife, I don't know if I would have left. But Anna is a young woman with a great career in front of her if she survives. and she's never going to abandon us. The other kids had all married and moved out of the house. Anna never did, and she stayed with him. And so that's when he became convinced you had to get out. And then it became, it was when the Nazis took over Austria, they assigned what were called trustees, a Nazi official to each major Jewish family, especially people who were influential and or wealthy. And Freud's family was singled out as well. And it was unclear. These trustees basically were there to extort whatever money they could from these Jewish families. But then it was unclear what they would do with them. Remember, this is before the Holocaust, per se, has happened. There's been plenty of Nazi anti-Semitism and brutality, but not wholesale mass murder. And so it was unclear, once they extorted money, a lot was left up to these trustees. Would they sign the papers to allow these people to leave, or would they just extort the money and then keep them there? And then eventually, of course, when the Holocaust happened, that would mean their death. And so Freud, the trustee who happened to be in charge of the Freuds, was a committed Nazi, a 35-year-old Nazi, but he had studied chemistry at the University of Vienna, where Freud had studied and taught. And his favorite chemistry professor was an old Jewish professor who had since died, who had been a friend of Freud's. And what happened is, as this trustee is sitting in Freud's apartment, going through all the financial stuff, but he's also reading some of Freud's work, and he begins to admire Freud. He says, this is a brilliant man. And so there's some admiration for him. And in the end, he discovers some of the stuff about Freud's finances, which was perfectly legal before the Nazis came into power, but immediately became illegal once they took power. And that might have stopped him from allowing him to leave, but he does not pass that on to his superiors. So what I say is that this rescue squad, which is consists mostly, of course, of people who were friends and colleagues, has this one odd duck in this story, who a Nazi who actually, by keeping his mouth shut, makes it possible for Freud to leave. But they did pay a huge amount of money, and Freud did not have that cash on hand, and Marie Bonaparte provided most of it. And William Bullitt, the U.S. ambassador of France, who was also a very wealthy man from Philadelphia, was willing to also provide some money if it was needed, but Marie Bonaparte provided most of it. And Freud later insisted on paying her back when he could, once they escaped.
That's an incredible story. I have just one question left, Andrew, and then you're no longer my prisoner. In 1938, I would imagine there were not a lot of countries that were eager to accept Jewish refugees from the Third Reich, you know, even, shall we say, celebrities. How did Freud manage to be accepted into England?
Yes, I mean, that's where Ernest Jones came in. Ernest Jones, who was a well-known physician by that time in England, who, in sort of the way these things happened, he happened to know some of the top officials in the government at the time from his days. He'd been in an ice skating club in London where he'd met some of them, and he used every connection. And then he had some medical connections to get them to sign off on entry permits for Freud. And Freud, by the way, wanted to get out, get his family out, get his personal doctor and his family out, and a couple of other people out. So it was a pretty large group. And it was one of the real— Anna Freud was just amazed the way Jones pulled this off, that he managed to get all this done in pretty much record time, so that once the Nazis finally said to Freud, okay, sign this paper and we'll let you go, essentially you paid all the bribes you need to, or people have paid them for you, they could go to London, which was, by the way, a place where Freud always thought, if there's any place I have to leave Vienna for, it will be England. He had two half-brothers who lived in England. His father, from an earlier marriage, had two older brothers. He had visited England when I think it was 19 or so. And he said, oh, you know, Britain's sort of a dreary place. The food's lousy. People can be a little surly, but I could live here. He went to the States only once in his life. It was interesting. He always was very condescending about the United States. Yeah, you know, it's very typical European thing. Oh, they're not so culturally sophisticated as we are. They're so materialistic and so forth. But in fact, some of his strongest support and some of his academic and material support came from followers in the United States. And he went to the U.S. once, but he hated the food. He complained that in this university where he visited, the toilets were too far away. Every little thing bothered him. And he said, England, that's a place I could live in. And he actually, when he got to London, he was amazed that he got a tremendous reception. People just poured out in the streets because Freud had become such a major figure. And in Vienna, he said, I was never a celebrity. Now I am. Well, he was a celebrity. But in Vienna, he was known. People were much more discreet. And I might nod to him or shake his hand if he was willing. But they didn't, flock around him. But because the story of Austria being taken over by the Nazis was such a big story, because Freud was such a big story, would he get out or not? By the time he got to England, people were falling all over themselves to applaud him, to greet him. And at one point, Freud had this really dry sense of humor, and sometimes it made you flinch a little bit. And he told Ernest Jones, who was helping arrange everything when they got to England, I'm almost tempted to say, thank you, Hitler. Thank you for what you've done, because it got me to England where I had no idea my life would be so good for the last part of his life. Again, you have to take it in context. He was not certainly saying thank you, Hitler, generally, but genuinely. He really was happy that if he had to leave Austria, he managed to get to London.
Incredible. Yeah, it's a great story.
Well, the book, once again, is Saving Freud, The Rescuers Who Brought Him to Freedom. Andrew Nagorski, how can people find out about you, sir?
Okay, the easiest way, I've got a website, just andrewnagorski.com. And Nagorski, N-A-G-O-R-S-K-I, by Polish name standards, is pretty simple. And there I have about all of my 8 books and a lot of my articles and biography. It's all there. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter. I'm reachable.
Excellent. Andrew Nagorski, I really appreciate taking the time for me, sir. This was a real pleasure. I enjoyed speaking with you.
It was a real pleasure for me too, Josh. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.